Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, returning for another installment of Terror, Mystery, and Mayhem. In this episode, we'll be delving into the baffling yet tragic demise of an unknown woman who met a grisly fate inside room 2805 at the Oslo Plaza Hotel in Norway. At approximately 10:45 p.m. on May 31st, 1995, a young white woman who spoke both German and English checked into the luxurious high-rise under the name Jennifer Fairgate, along with a man named Lois Fairgate. Yet, by June 3rd, just a few days later, Jennifer would be discovered deceased with a gunshot wound to her forehead, and there would be no sign of Lois. But that's just the beginning. The mystery builds from there. It all starts on May 22, 1995, when Oslo Plaza Hotel receives a call from Jennifer Fairgate to make a reservation. It's only 1995, so this essentially predates the popular option of being able to book online. Now, Jennifer reserves the room with the last name Fairgate, which is misheard as Fairgate by the person helping her, almost certainly because Fairgate is a common name, but Fairgate is a nearly non-existent name. She makes accommodations for two guests. Of course, Lois is traditionally a woman's name, except in France, and we later learn she definitely intended this part of the booking to be for a man because she mentioned her husband coming with her. So, unfortunately, we don't know the dates initially booked because they were changed during a second call with the hotel on May 31st, which was a Wednesday. In that call, Jennifer asks to have her reservation moved up to that night and also asserts she'll be arriving with another person. Records show that the young woman did in fact check in with the front desk that night around 10:45 p.m. That's generally the time of day when the lobby is most crowded, and to be clear, this hotel is basically the crown jewel of the surrounding skyline, known for being the second tallest building in the country, boasting close to 700 rooms at the facility over 34 floors. If you check in at peak times, you're far less memorable that way. You're in a hotel lobby full of people. It also means the staff is overworked, and trying to expedite this process as quickly as possible to get tired, grumpy travelers where they're going. Sadly, that haste lends itself to some employees breaking company policy with regard to checking identification, taking passport numbers, or anything similar to avoid fraud. Yet, somehow, Jennifer Fairgate not only checks in without showing ID for herself and the man supposedly accompanying her, but also manages to get the room without offering any form of payment. It's baffling. So, Jennifer lists her age as 21 with the hotel, but was considered to be more likely 25 to 30 years of age by witnesses. The autopsy actually put the victim's age at 24. So, we can say that Jennifer had cause to lie about her age. Usually people lie about their age to seem older, such as being 19 and saying you're 21 to get a drink, or they lie to say they're younger due to shame of the number being too high or being excluded for that reason. Yet, it would be rare for any logic of that sort to require a young woman of 24 to say she's actually 21. There isn't much to gain by it, unless your goal is deception. Lying to say you're older might get you a drink when you're underage. Lying to say you're younger might get you a date with someone who would otherwise believe you're too old. But lying on a sign-in sheet at a hotel really has no practical value. If witnesses thought she was 25 to 30 and she was actually 24, listing herself as 21 is merely a desperate attempt to make people assume she's someone she's not. Now, why would she do that? Well, the easiest answer is that she already knows that someone, specifically the police, will be obtaining this document at a later time. And when they do, it isn't going to help determine her identity in any way. We could assume this was done in an effort to not be held accountable for paying for the hotel room, but with the result being death, it seems related to that event. So right off the bat, from identification to the passports, and even including a form of payment to be used, there's nothing. It's a blank slate. Who is this woman? The hotel is certainly not helping themselves here. Now, again, who is this woman? That's the question. And the answer is clearly that she doesn't want us to know. One woman who was working the front desk during that time says that she's certain that even though she didn't check the couple in, she indeed saw both of them together later, perhaps exchanging currency. So, let's talk about Jennifer's appearance. How is she dressed for this? Well, this is the most popular time to check into the hotel because it's right after the time in which the late flights for the evening arrive, which means you not only have plenty of visitors in the form of tourists and business people, but this is also the heaviest traffic for flight attendants arriving for the night. They generally wake the next morning and fly out again, so they travel lightly and often appear similar because they're showing up in their uniforms with a coat over top. Yes, it's about to be June, but we're talking Norway around 11 p.m. in the dark. It's cold enough. So the initial thought after her death is that this young woman could be a flight attendant for an airline. She's dressed professionally in a black skirt with black stockings along with a dark leather jacket. According to one witness, she also pulls a small wheeled suitcase alongside her, something extremely common today, but at that time would have been more likely a method employed by flight attendants and pilots who were often so rushed that the wheeled items allowed them to move more quickly to get where they were going. Passengers, of course, noticed the innovation, and the popularization of that type of bag followed. Yes, men were so primitive and full of worthless pride that even when it became apparent wheeled luggage was a great thing, they still wanted to carry suitcases with handles. That old habit died hard. So, back in 1995, the witnesses in the lobby believed someone of that age, with that look, arriving around that time, with that wheeled luggage and sparse luggage, would likely be a flight attendant. So let's add to all of this the physical characteristics of her hair. It's very short, very dark, described as black, and has sort of a spiked look to it. Of course, we have many other witnesses who never saw this woman with anyone during her stay, and that fits the mold of her being a flight attendant. Yet, the guest registration says she's not alone. So how do we, as interested observers here, or better yet, analysts, move forward understanding the truth? I suggest we use psychology to create an emotional narrative. What's nature trying to say with her brain, specifically with her choices? Okay, so we know she speaks German and English. As witnesses on staff attested to hearing her first communicate in English when she called, and later speak German, both fluently. The German is said to have been clean, in the sense that she didn't have an accent. A composite of the woman's head and face constructed after her death, to me, appears decidedly European, most likely German, but possibly Belgian, yet she also seems like she could be from a Scandinavian country or somewhere nearby. If she speaks German, however, and also English, my money is on Germany. It's the most likely origin for someone who fluently speaks both of these languages. Now, if she claims to be checking in with someone else named Lois, and it's a man, that man is going to be French. So we ask ourselves, when you arrive as a couple to check in at the front desk of a hotel, where would you generally be located in relation to that person as you wait in line? You stand next to each other, right? Couples usually do that. So, if we look at a map, we should see that France and Germany are located next to each other, more or less. And they are. They border each other, with France to the west and Germany to the east. So, Lois is France, and Jennifer represents Germany. Now, we understand Lois can't actually be legitimized at this point. We don't know this is a real person. we can only account for the fact the reservation was made for two, and the guest book revealed the same. However, we don't know for sure. A witness did see him, but again, we don't know if she's correct. So, let's say Lois doesn't exist. Well, he does, sort of, but we'll get to that. Let's say we're Jennifer. We live in Germany, and we're unhappy, depressed, maybe worse, like suicide kind of miserable. And the path to peace, the suicidal ideation, has begun to manifest. Well, I've discussed the notion of geographical movement to solve an emotional issue, and the search to find higher ground when one is drowning psychologically. So we should remain aware of that here. Do we see that? Yes. Let's consider the map again. There's no higher ground on a map. It's two-dimensional. So the equivalent of up, so to speak, on a map is north. If we're in Philly one weekend and are heading to Manhattan, we would say something like, I'm driving up to New York. Conversely, if you were in Boston and driving to Baltimore, you'd say something like, I'm driving down to Baltimore. There's not actually any vertical travel taking place. You don't lift off into space. So, while the top of the world is actually the peak of Mount Everest, we also think of the North Pole that way, yet in a different context. Everest is the top of the world in true three-dimensional terms, while the North Pole is the same in two-dimensional terms. What that means is that the three-dimensional choice is the tangible or physical answer, aka fact, while the two-dimensional answer is a matter of perception. And that's fitting because your emotional life, which is played out through your imagination in your head, is only capable of producing two-dimensional images. Your eyes offer you the three-dimensional reality. That's why we so easily find movie screens, our phone's display, or a TV screen so enjoyable. They don't need to offer 3D like reality because our imaginations are constructed that way. They're two-dimensional. Even if you buy a 3D TV or see a 3D movie, you're being offered a false perception through the manipulation of two-dimensional images. If you walk up to the screen and touch it, it's flat. There's nothing raised in terms of the images. So, this is the reason for people indulging geographical movement as an emotional solution when they reach the end of their rope psychologically. It allows a person to misguidedly utilize their two-dimensional emotional world, or imagination, on a two-dimensional physical canvas that actually doesn't exist. They mistakenly believe this is finding harmony, and that their emotional goals have become achievable. So, if you're drowning, emotionally, and need to get to higher ground, which way do you go? Up. Of course, if you were actually drowning, like physically drowning, you would literally go up in a three-dimensional sense. But if you're employing the physical manifestation of your emotional issue, up then becomes what it would be in a two-dimensional context as you see on a map. So basically, up is north. So if I'm correct, we should be able to look at the map and, starting in Germany, where we think Jennifer originated, trace a line directly north or up that takes us right to Oslo, Norway, where the hotel is. And bingo, that's the case. Not only is Oslo directly north of Germany, or up, or above it, so to speak, but Oslo is also the northernmost major city in that region. It's the end of the line going up. So, for all intents and purposes, in a two-dimensional sense, it's as high as you can go to find a place like that. So psychologically, I believe this person is drowning and trying to get to higher ground. That's what she wants. That means we should not only see that symbolized in her choice of destination, but also the hotel. she went directly north or up as far as she could go, and now she's going to do the same in the context of her destination, if I'm correct. And there we have it. What hotel does she choose? Oslo Plaza. It's the tallest hotel in the country and the second tallest building overall. Obviously, you choose the hotel instead of the tallest building because that's the one to which you can gain access. You can get a room there. So, for a visitor, this is the tallest building in which you could stay. And this hotel extends into the skyline, into the clouds, like an arm reaching for something, perhaps the sky or the hand of God. It's striking. It's by far taller than the other buildings surrounding it, almost to a fault. So we have Jennifer choosing to go up or north as far as she can go, at which point she chooses the tallest building in which she can stay. And if we're still on track, she should also request a room on a high floor, which she gets. She says she requires a room in the tower, which is at the top of the building, going from floors 28 through 34. Jennifer's room is on the 28th floor, at the beginning of the tower, so she goes as high as she can go. This means every move she has made so far has been in the context of rising, ascending, going north, going up, seeking higher ground, etc. They all follow that theme. But if you're drowning emotionally, there's no such thing as reaching higher ground physically to cure the ailment. Yet people still try to run physically from rising emotional waters and get washed away in a psychological flood of uncontrollable desire to break free. So no matter how high of a floor you choose, the waters are going to keep rising. You'll drown. And they know that. But like people going down with a ship out on the ocean at night in freezing waters, they keep repositioning themselves to live just a little longer, to hold out hope of rescue, until finally they submerge. That's what we do. That's who we are. We try to survive until death swallows us. Depressed people can plan their suicide and hope it doesn't happen all at once. In fact, that's often what transpires. People find a reason to live at the last moment. Or they botch the suicide, either consciously or not, and it serves as a cry for help. But for the most part, every miserable person is still hoping something will stop the pain. That's the point. They resort to physical actions to solve an emotional issue, which is something you can't do unless you're willing to die to stop hurting. In the end, sometimes suicide plays out as an inevitability, meaning the person is hanging on to hope, but not doing anything to produce results. So the suicide simply occurs as a result of apathy or reaching a point where it's the only remaining action one can take to proceed to the goal of not hurting anymore. Essentially, people often want to live and also want to die. There's a duality. Of course, we're programmed to feel incredible shame in relation to suicidal thoughts because it's the most self-destructive behavior in existence. Nature wants you to really consider your options before removing yourself from the gene pool. And for that reason, some people struggle with this shame so greatly that it causes them to do things such as try to disappear or remain unidentified when killing themselves. Other times, it's all about not giving the person or people who wronged you the satisfaction of knowing they got the best of you. Maybe you have a parent and you think of them learning about you committing suicide, and you just can't deal with that thought. Maybe you have children, or a spouse, or anything else for that matter. At some time, and in some place in our lives, we all just want to fucking disappear. sometimes it's just for 5 minutes while your kids are driving you crazy, or your boss is being obnoxious at work. But other times, we could literally curl up into the fetal position with our heads buried between our arms to dull the sound of madness invading our minds. We close our eyes and think of the peace of darkness and silence. We wonder how the hell we'll get past this moment. But then, somehow, we do. It passes. And we get up. We move on. But when the end comes, you just run to higher ground and wait to drown, repositioning yourself on top of the sinking ship, knowing full well the effort is futile. Elisa Lam is a great example of this. She literally drowned in a water tank on the roof of a hotel in the midst of a serious depression. She kept climbing up from her room to the roof, using the elevator and the fire escape, and then finally the ladder leading to the top of the water tanks, until there was no higher ground to which she could escape. That's when she drowned, literally. I believe that we'll see that in this case. This hotel stay over the next several days for Jennifer Fergate is going to be the equivalent of the people on the sinking ship repositioning themselves as the water rises and the end nears. But again, her emotional desires are manifesting, so we should be able to extract that tragic truth from the rest of the psychological narrative in the same way as we did for her trip leading to the Oslo Plaza Hotel. Let's start with one factor I find quite revealing, which is that fake name she's using, Jennifer Fergate. How do we deconstruct that name to find the intention buried within? Well, like everything else in this world, we can use the hero's journey. It's your story, mine, and that of every protagonist you meet. We perceive life in a three-act structure of birth, life, and death, and therefore utilize that formula when constructing entertainment. In truth, you can use as many acts as you like, but when all is said and done, they have to express birth, life, death. Not literally, of course. They could in any given story, but the birth, life, death in question, if not the person's lifespan itself, refers to the birth, life, and death of an idea, a way of doing things. We shed all of our old ways for the new as we evolve. What it means is that, in the absence of evolution, meaning a state of emotional stagnancy on the part of the protagonist, the only thing we can indulge is tragedy. If you change, aka evolve, you thrive. If you refuse, the stagnancy leads to some type of death. So, this is generally how you'd structure a story, which we all know. Act 1, or birth, is the beginning, and Act 3, or death, is the end. But in between, Act 2, the longest section, is life. The difference between the successful protagonist and the tragic protagonist is that the successful one changes in Act 2, while the tragic protagonist keeps employing the same methods throughout and fails due to lack of evolution of thought in her mind, leading to lack of innovation in the material world that's required to achieve the goal. Evolution of thought must precede evolution of your physical reality. Without learning anything and continuing to plow through your Act 2 in the absence of change, you will fail. All of which is to say, Act 2 essentially consists of two parts divided in the middle. The first half of Act 2, taking place prior to the midpoint of the story, serves as a time of emotional deconstruction. The protagonist has an external goal in the material world and goes after it armed only with the knowledge and maturity they possess at that time. but what they soon learn is that the goal isn't achievable under those terms, despite the fact they expected it to be and wanted it to be. So they have to change, or they die, aka their chances of success die. That means the first half of Act 2 deconstructs all of the prideful and unrealistic notions the protagonist has about how easy the goal will be to achieve. This deconstruction has a single purpose, which is to show the hero that evolution of thought, or emotion, followed by innovation in the material world based on what you learned, is the only way to succeed. We do that individually and also as a species. So, if the first half of Act 2 is deconstruction, and the midpoint serves as the point of no return, so to speak, the time at which you are committed to the journey, then the latter half of Act 2 must be reconstruction. Knowing we need to change to succeed, and now being fully committed, passing the halfway mark of the journey, we begin to implement what we've learned in the deconstruction phase, right as the antagonistic forces kick into high gear to start the reconstruction phase. And if we've done it right, that leads to a climactic showdown with our shadow, or the main antagonist, at the end of Act 2, aka the end of the reconstruction phase, in which the specific lesson we learned that led to evolution of thought, and by extension, innovation in the material world thereafter, is rendered as a solution. A lesson learned is the only thing that can kill our demons, physical or emotional. So with that said, given the tragic protagonist, if there is no change, we don't actually have a deconstruction phase immediately followed by reconstruction in Act 2. If the protagonist learns nothing, they just keep doing the same thing throughout the film, meaning that deconstruction leads to demolition instead of reconstruction. There is no change. Instead of an emotional death, we get a physical one. The tragic protagonist ends up dead, in prison, or even ostracized. Instead of emotional growth, lack of change in a protagonist produces physical death, aka material loss. So anybody traveling that tragic path in which the deconstruction phase, or first half, ends and they simply continue over the midpoint of the story without changing is going to employ the same methods in the first half of Act 2 as they do in the second half. Accordingly, in the creation of Jennifer's narrative, if it is, in fact, the physical manifestation of an emotional issue leading to tragedy, we should be able to prove it using any element of the story. And it's already blatantly obvious to me. Nature is sending the message so clearly. Look at the name. Jennifer. Okay, that's the first half. So we can say after the first name that we've reached the midpoint of her name like we do the midpoint of the story. Now, the second half of her name, like the second half of the story, is Fergate. Notice the last three letters of her first name are the same as the first three letters of her last name. The deconstruction phase is the same as what should be the reconstruction phase. There's no change in those spots, just like there's no change in those places in a tragic narrative. And then look what we find at the end of the last name after F-E-R. The word gate. This woman has traveled to a place that she's essentially using as a gateway to the heavens. She went up on the map. She went up in the tallest building around. And this place is going to serve as a gate to what comes next. We always talk about the gates of heaven or the gates of hell. So the name ends in gate because that is her physical destination, the gates of heaven she wants to ascend. So Fairgate, as the front desk signed her in, is a popular name. But she didn't use that, even at their urging. Despite being prompted as Fairgate, she still insisted on signing twice as Fairgate. And why? If she conceded Fairgate, the end of the first name, aka deconstruction phase, using the letters F-E-R, wouldn't match the beginning of the reconstruction phase that also uses F-E-R, and therefore the symbolic relevance of her not changing would be negated. Nature, or evolution, needs to tell us through symbolism and metaphor that this is a tragedy, and uses her brain to comply by way of offering intuitive messages. So, this is where it gets fascinating for me. What all of this means is that Lois ain't real. In the same way France is split from Germany by a border, but the two are still connected by land, your brain is that connected land, while your psyche can be split into two separate entities, the protagonist and shadow. The shadow just has to be an antagonist. No matter who it is in a story, it always represents the dark side. The antagonist is the height of your power if you choose darkness, while the protagonist is the same for the light. But in order to be the light, you have to learn and innovate by overcoming darkness. Again, that happens in a climactic showdown between the two at the end of Act 2. If the protagonist has learned the emotional lesson and changes, she wins. If not, the antagonist will win. The antagonist in any story is simply the person who won't change, whether it's you or another entity that you're facing. So in this story, our antagonist is going to be the mystery man, Lois. There will be a showdown at the end of Act 2 between Jennifer and Lois. The only question is, do we know if Lois is real? If this is a tragedy, then like one witness suggests from the lobby on the night of check-in, Jennifer was alone, and her shadow, therefore, was herself. She was suffering an emotional breakdown, and Lois was merely her shadow. But if Lois is real and was actually standing there, then she has a tangible adversary to combat. One way or another, someone is going to put a gun to her forehead and pull the trigger. That person was Lois. The job we have moving forward is to learn if Lois was an actual person or a fictionalized entity used to deflect the reality of suicide. So was Jennifer's climactic showdown at the end of Act 2 with Lois a murder or suicide? An answer to our question lies in being able to determine, again, if Lois is real. So let's do it. As we begin, again, the emotional narrative I see is one which clearly paints a portrait of suicide. But as the facts and witness statements unfold, confusion arises. Doubt looms. Evidence starts to point to murder. So they checked in on Wednesday night, May 31st, around 10:45 p.m. By 7:30 p.m. on Saturday, June 3rd, a receptionist working at the front desk has noticed that they had not yet paid for their room, something that should have been completed at check-in. No one is quite sure how the couple, or even just Jennifer, managed to accomplish all of this without payment, a passport, driver's license, or anything else. My guess is that she probably told someone at the front desk that she left her purse in a cab or something like that and promised to come back as soon as possible, but didn't. In fact, by Saturday evening, there had already been two messages sent to the room requesting someone inside contact the cashier downstairs. It was 1995, so the message would run across the TV screen in the room rather than be sent by email. it's not clear if they also called the room. Anyhow, each of the first two times it happened, somebody in the room holding the remote control pressed the OK button to acknowledge the message was received. More on that later. But again, look what we have. Three acts. Birth, life, death. We have three attempts at contacting this woman, and she is going to die right after the third one. Three strikes, and you are out. She's had two warnings to come to them to pay them for the room. Instinctively, we know that's the way things work. So, as this receptionist sends the third message to contact the cashier, the message is acknowledged by someone hitting the OK button on the remote control to the TV in room 2805. The receptionist from the front desk calls housekeeping to try to get the inside scoop on these people. But to her surprise, housekeeping tells her they haven't been in the room to clean or leave fresh linens since Thursday morning. They say the Do Not Disturb sign has been hanging outside the door for a couple of days. So the receptionist gets worried about what's going on up there and contacts security to check on the occupants of room 2805. A part-time weekend security guard makes his way up to the room. He knocks on the door. Right after he does that, a gunshot erupts from within the room. I mean, right after he knocks. The guard immediately recognizes the sound for what it is and takes cover behind some type of column extending from the wall in the hallway. To his knowledge, there are two people in the room, checked in as Lois and Jennifer Fairgate. So his instinct isn't to believe a suicide occurred. To him, it seems more likely a murder. That means someone who's armed is still inside the room. If that person is going to come out, the guard is probably going to get shot. So he flees to the guard station downstairs, choosing to not shout the news over his radio because the entire hotel staff would hear it and panic. He was hoping to contain the incident to that room. Of course, he doesn't know anyone's actually been killed, but he believes a shot was fired. So he lets the front desk know, along with the head of security for the building, and the police are called as well, which is great, except 15 minutes pass before anyone goes back up to room 2805. So we don't know if anyone came or went from inside the room, at least not to this point. The two security people are the first to arrive upstairs. I would think in the case of a gunshot, unarmed security would want to avoid the room altogether, but they go up there before the police and knock. No one answers the door. Nobody responds to their calls. Naturally, if you've already made one stupid move, you might as well assume even more risk. So that's when the head of security uses a key card to open the door. They call out again, but they don't hear anybody from inside the room. Now, what's important here is that the head of security finds the door double locked, meaning it's locked from the outside by default of someone entering and closing the door, and also locked from the inside because somebody in the room turned a handle up. So, when you open the door on this room, the foot of the bed is straight back, and the rest of the bed is concealed by the wall on your left that borders the bathroom. From this vantage point, however, the men can see a well-dressed woman lying on her back on the bed, with her feet down on the floor at the foot of it. Her hands are up on her chest, and she's not moving, nor is she making a noise. There's some type of smell permeating from the room. Something like death. Jennifer Fairgate is found on the bed, face up, with a large bullet hole in her forehead. They confirm she's dead and assume the blast killed her instantly. It's a bloodbath. In her right hand, lying across her chest, is a Browning 9mm, which is later confirmed as being the instrument used to kill her. Police find no sign of a struggle, or even any indication another person has been staying in the room. They learned two shots were fired. The first was fired downward into a pillow, which sent the bullet through the mattress. It almost seems as though the pillow was intended to be a silencer, but without anything having been underneath it, a closer look suggests its purpose was that of muffling the sound of a test shot that preceded the fatal round to come. Of course, it blows her brains out the back of her head, tears through the mattress, and ends up on the floor beneath the bed, which is concrete. There was a bullet left in the chamber of the gun, which would have loaded automatically, and also 7 additional rounds in the clip. That's when the cops notice the serial number has been professionally removed from the gun, meaning someone used acid to blast it away rather than a crude method like shaving it with a nail file. Testing done over the last few decades was able to recover most of the number, with the exception of 3 digits. So they can narrow it down to a particular country of origin in terms of where it was manufactured, but who bought or owned it, or even where, is anybody's guess. We might never know. But what does that say about the gun, as compared to what we know about the events that took place at check-in down in the lobby? She's hiding her identity. Or someone else is doing it for her, because that trail would also lead back to him. To add to that theme, we soon discover she has no driver's license, passport, makeup, or even toiletries. And we learn the information she gave at the front desk, in terms of her home address and name, are false. There's no Jennifer Fergate in Belgium, so obviously she doesn't live at the address she provided. Nor does the Lois character, who, if he actually exists, is nowhere to be found at this point. Still, though, it sort of seems like she just killed herself, right? Well, we're going to learn Jennifer has no blood, meaning spatter, or gunshot residue on her right hand holding the gun. The hand which obviously would have been the one to pull the trigger at point-blank range. Those things would normally be present in the event of a suicide. But they're not. Now, Jennifer also doesn't have a purse with her, or any similar type of handbag, but she does have a black attaché. Inside it, the police find nothing but 25 additional rounds of 9mm ammunition, the same as what was loaded in the gun. Why did she have so much ammo? Was she planning something other than suicide, and couldn't bring herself to do it? Or was there another gun? Or gunman? Was this an assassination attempt of some kind? Or was there another gun or gunman? Well, one thing of note found in the room is a bottle of men's cologne with a sparse amount left in the bottom. It's a heavy, strong, masculine sort of scent that wouldn't typically be worn by women. Accordingly, Jennifer was not wearing the scent at the time of her death. So, who was the owner of the cologne? If it was hers, why did she have it? Let's examine some of these things. We could say the cologne was left behind by a man who shot this woman, wiped his prints, or wore gloves, and then put the gun in her hand before leaving with his things. Or we could say Jennifer intended to spray the cologne before killing herself to make it seem as though a man had just been in the room. Or even the bottle itself was intended to fool the staff and police into thinking Lois was real. Of course, Lois could have been taken hostage by a third person, aka the gunman, in the room after Jennifer was shot, and then killed elsewhere, right? Well, the access records for the door on room 2805 show that nobody came or went during the 15 minutes between the security guard leaving and returning with his boss. Is it possible someone could shortcut the electrical system to avoid detection? Yes. Of course, we also have to consider that when you open the door from the inside, it doesn't register on their electrical system. It's only when you use the key card from the outside. Now, to add to that, we will also learn that nobody actually entered the room using a key card prior to this time, on that night, I mean, and so we also know there's no record of anyone entering. So without a record of them leaving, we can say that no one ever entered, unless they were friendly and let in by one of the occupants of the room. So we can't actually know what happened in that situation. The question has been posed about this possibly being a government assassination against a spy, since Jennifer Fergate is a fake name. However, the sequence of events doesn't make much sense in that context. The security guard knocked on the door, and not until after that did the shot ring out. If you're in that room on the 28th floor, about to kill a person without a silencer on the gun, and someone has just knocked on the door, it is, without question, the absolute worst time to pull the trigger. If you're the assassin, you don't know who's knocking on the door. It could be the police. But there's no hesitation to pull the trigger. None. That's the sign of a desperate move. It's reactionary. It's somebody reacting to the guard coming to the door. When considered in combination with the final message that had just been sent to the TV about contacting the cashier, it's not difficult to conclude the person who hit the button to acknowledge it knew the time was running out as it relates to being able to occupy the room. The end was coming, and with it, if she didn't leave, someone was going to come and get her out. So I hear this gunshot at this time, and what I sense is desperation, because otherwise it's absolute stupidity. Okay, so 34 rounds of ammo is excessive preparation for a suicide, and I think that's the perception intentionally being fabricated here. In truth, I think the smallest boxes of ammo you can buy for a weapon of this type, meaning a 9mm, would offer you 50 rounds. You can buy in bulk, but generally you don't find this stuff available in smaller counts. So whether this woman stole the gun and ammo from a family member or stranger, or even legally or illegally purchased it herself, along with the ammo, that type of situation would lend itself to a high probability she would acquire a box of at least 50 rounds. That box could have been opened already, and some of the contents used. We don't know. But I can tell you this for sure. A 9mm with a single magazine is the least efficient way to carry out the shooting of multiple people. Once you empty that clip, you have to stop and manually reload. I mean, we're talking each bullet. In terms of a shooting, you're very rarely going to get that type of time. Someone is going to tackle you when you stop to reload, or shoot you. It's the primary reason for limiting the size of magazines on weapons that citizens own. The smaller magazine makes you less efficient. If you only have one and need to manually reload, your chances of ever coming close to firing all of those 34 rounds isn't very good at all. On top of that, this woman is found dead wearing heels, which would be the worst choice of shoes for trying to maneuver your way through a mass shooting. Of course, it's also possible there were only one or two intended targets, and she might have expected a shootout with one or two people if something went wrong. She could have been an assassin or spy whose cover was blown and ended up dead. But when we boil all of this down to its basic elements, only two shots are fired, one which seems to be a test shot, and another deemed a suicide. There's no struggle, there's no argument, nothing else is amiss. The serial number being scratched off suggests somebody believes the weapon will be lost and found, and they don't want it traced back to them by the police. That could have happened at any point in the ownership chain. But if this is a suicide in a locked room, as it appears likely to be, that circumstance dictates with 100% certainty that the gun will not only be lost by the owner and found by the police, but in a situation where the owner is still present, even if dead. She needed the serial number removed from the gun more than any other person would if she was trying to hide her identity, and that seems apparent by the rest of the evidence at play in this case. Okay, so this is when it gets a bit strange. The police notice all of the labels are cut out of her clothing. With the exception of a coat that wouldn't allow you to remove the label without ruining the lining. We could say this was done for the purpose of comfort, but we already have a strong theme of negating identity present in the evidence so far, from the lobby to the room to the death itself. Now, on a practical level, we understand most clothing we buy from stores isn't unique. Other people will buy those same designs and colors in large numbers, meaning the labels don't actually offer any type of specificity about any one person. Even if you know the size, there are still many other people wearing it. So, the labels aren't hiding anything in this instance. They're saying something. And again, nature speaks in symbolism and metaphor. And so this is how we'll need to interpret. What do we know about suicide among young people? Often, it's the product of depression, social pressures, inability to deal with emotional and physical changes, issues of identity or self-hatred, or even the bullying that ensues from things like that. People see you in a certain way, and they label you. And you suffer the wrath of that label. You could be called a slut, a Jesus freak, a racial slur, a wimp, an addict, a quitter, a killer, a loser, a flake, a troublemaker, a scam artist, a waste of life, an underachiever, a leech, a problem, a failure, a burden, and so on. You might have the whole world telling you this, or it could just be yourself. Either way, it hurts. We don't like the labels society places upon us. The wrath, the scorn, the assumptions, the prejudice, the fear. It's an emotional prison, a cage with invisible bars. And it's even worse when we believe them. And even worse than that, when we believe ourselves. And guess what that does? When we believe them, or even ourselves, when we accept that scarlet letter, that burden, as truth, we feel a very specific type of emotion in the aftermath. Shame. We too often hear about teens getting bullied and killing themselves, and the reason they go to such extremes is that they can't find an emotional way to escape the pain of being labeled something and continually paying a price for being that thing. Their desire to transcend that inescapable label as someone worthy of wrath, scorn, and ostracism leads to an emotional death where only physical solutions remain. Suicide alleviates them of being the thing other people hate, and by extension of that, the thing they have come to hate about themselves through the process of being bullied. So essentially, what do? By killing themselves, they physically remove the labels that cause them such terrible psychological pain, the labels which they were not able to remove emotionally. The removal of the tags on Jennifer Fergate's clothing is nature telling us that she couldn't transcend her issues, or scarlet letter, or labels, emotionally, and desired to free herself physically for lack of a better solution. Labels define any piece of clothing. They're placed on the items, stitched or stamped on by others, and the clothing itself is never able to shed the labels. The clothing with labels removed is a metaphor describing what Jennifer wanted. She wanted to be free of the way she defined herself and/or how society labeled her. So, we see she's wearing black clothing. If you were to cut the labels out of these items and then look closely at the spots where the labels had been, or even put them under a microscope, what would you see? You'd probably see very short, black, spiky sort of threads in the exact place along the stitching where the tag was removed. If that image mirrors something else in terms of hiding identity, it should be apparent to us. So let's ask ourselves, what else is short, black, and spiked Jennifer's hair? She wanted to be free of something and was trying to represent that physically in the absence of being able to do so emotionally. If you place that desire in the context of hair and in accordance with the labels on the clothing, what it says is that Jennifer probably cut her hair off just like the labels and changed the color, because these are both methods she can employ to hide identity. And again, we know she wants to hide her identity in relation to shame, specifically labels or tags, and so cutting things free physically is very attractive. Nature is telling us why. So I think the reason we see extremes in terms of the hair, meaning that it's as short as it can reasonably get without drawing attention as being odd, and also as dark as it can get by being black, is that this representation is furthest from the truth. If I had to guess, I'd say this woman was known for having longer, lighter hair, and that difference might have played a factor in family or friends trying to identify her after the fact. If she disguised her identity in multiple other ways, I have no reason to believe she wouldn't change her hair. It's easy and very effective. Of course, we have to admit that another person could have removed these things from her clothing, and someone else could have shot her. But who would that be? Well, one thing the police find inside room 2805 is a newspaper inside a plastic bag, meaning a plastic sleeve intended for that purpose. Usually such things were used for rainy days and outdoor delivery, but hotels would also employ them inside the buildings when leaving them at guests' doors for various reasons, like fresh print can leave ink on the carpet, and bagging the papers with plastic allows you to number them with the room where they should be delivered. You don't need a separate list. So, the problem we find with the newspaper in room 2805 is that it's marked with the number of a room down the hallway by the elevators, room 2816. Did someone else come to Jennifer's room and a disagreement ensued? Or did she just take their paper? Well, we'll talk more about that, but we also have to consider we don't know the location of this Lois person. He's gone without a trace. Vanished. So, who was Lois? And did he kill her? Like I said, I think the name Lois was chosen because it's most often a female name, and Jennifer, so to speak, could identify with that, while also using it as a man's name to create a fictitious assailant. She's in a state of psychological disunity due to her emotional ailment, meaning she has gone from unity to having a want and a need that must be merged through innovation by way of evolution of thought. Basically, she has to figure out a way to mature and grow to get past this. Her psyche is fractured. She must change to make the want and need intertwine. That's what Jennifer needs to do. What she wants is for all of the pain to end. In the absence of Jennifer making that happen through emotional growth over time, the shortcut or physical option is suicide. That's the shadow calling, the dark side. With suicide being an act that affords the participant great shame, which is taken to an extreme in this case by extracting the victim's identity in its entirety, making the incident appear to be murder relieves the perception of shame by making the death involuntary. If it was committed by someone else, then it wasn't a suicide, and we don't have physical evidence of Lois being real. We only have inference. Lois, in my mind, was simply the personification of Jennifer's emotional issue. The psychological issue is what really killed her, so she assigns identity and blame to it in the context of a physical solution rather than emotional because it's a tragedy. But that gives us some insight into her mind state. She thinks this is someone else's fault. She's been labeled, whether by a person, group, society, and/or herself, and wants to be free of that identity. Manufacturing a false killer in a suicide says A, she couldn't deal with the shame, and B, she's blaming someone else. And like it is in real life, once a tragedy happens, we see that only Jennifer herself was to blame. And we assume this issue was going on at home because she's posing as a traveler, someone who gets away from it all. But the problem is in her head. She can't get away from it by running. And she knows it. So in the end, she gets away from nothing. The waters keep rising, and when she can no longer reposition herself, when the security guard finally shows up at the door, as her ship is sinking below the water, she drowns. Now, as I said, we do still have one item of clothing, the coat, which has its label, or tag, inside because removing it would damage the lining. In accordance with my assessment that this woman is from Germany, that's where the coat was made. It doesn't mean she definitely acquired it there, but if she speaks fluent German and is wearing a coat made in Germany while providing a false Belgian address and the name of a fake French husband who was standing right next to her as Germany appears next to France on a map, then my belief is that she's German. Jennifer also had dental work done that showed methods only common to approximately three European countries, one of which was Germany. We find other clothing items in the closet as well. Yet, not only are they incomplete outfits, meaning oddities like having no panties with multiple bras, but the bag she's carrying doesn't seem big enough to house all of these items. It seems as though another bag would be needed to carry all of these things. And of course, we remember that the woman in the lobby, one witness, said she saw her with a wheeled suitcase. But the police don't find this suitcase. It's not in the room when they arrive. Of course, that's when we learn from one of the maids who cleaned her room on Thursday that she saw a second pair of shoes in the closet when she cleaned. She says they were black, like the other heels Jennifer was wearing, but much nicer. She says the ones Jennifer had on her feet wouldn't get her attention, but the ones in the closet were so nice she had to look inside them to see who made the shoes. Great. So, who made them? Of course, she couldn't remember. And that tells me she's lying. It's the only thing she wanted to know, and the only thing she can't remember. Maids clean a lot of rooms. It's quite possible she saw the shoes elsewhere and falsely attributed them to being in room 2805 by way of hindsight bias. Furthermore, I don't buy the assertion all of these clothes couldn't fit into a small travel bag. It's nonsense. The witness from the lobby who said she saw Jennifer with a wheeled suitcase and not just a small travel bag changed her story after being interviewed for the first time. It wasn't until the second occasion that she mentioned the suitcase. So again, just like the maid, somebody working the front desk would see a lot of people coming and going to a lot of different rooms. To me, confusion seems apparent. I don't think we can rely on these witness sightings, especially since a few of them contradict each other. Now, remember the attaché? That was also made by a German manufacturer. All of the fingerprints lifted from the room match Jennifer. The only other people who saw her were those who delivered room service a couple times. She gave them significant tips in cash, perhaps even five times as much as they would normally get. Yet, there was no cash found in the room with her. And just like there were no prints on the gun, there were none on the magazine either. Do you remember the rising emotional waters I talked about? How the hotel became the manifestation of Jennifer's desire to escape to higher ground emotionally? Well, from late May into June 1995, the eastern part of Norway, in which Oslo is located, was suffering the effects of a very particular type of natural disaster. Flooding. This would have been on the news. It would have drawn her due to the metaphorical or symbolic implications. The hotel was the highest ground available, and the waters were literally rising, something that she was feeling emotionally. She was drawn to this place. Which brings up a great question. If this woman is foreign and just came here to kill herself due to shame of not wanting anyone to know back home, then why weren't the police able to account for anyone like this entering the country? What we learn is that there were a lot of workers on strike at the time, which included police officers at the airport, leaving only one passport officer on duty that very busy night. Could Jennifer have slipped through at the busiest time of day during a strike? That's probably what happened. But we don't know. They weren't able to identify her through the airlines. Yet, again, it was 1995. It's possible they simply just missed her. There's also a ferry that travels from Germany to Norway, but that seems excessive. The person appears as though she traveled by air. We assume she did. She was thought to be a flight attendant. It's more than possible she stayed somewhere else the previous night or even for days or weeks prior to checking into Oslo Plaza as a means of avoiding being identified on passenger logs for the airlines. This is something she probably would have considered beforehand, given that Norway is detached from most other destinations, and travelers are therefore far more likely to arrive by way of a flight. In today's world, this method of remaining unidentified that Jennifer has chosen simply would not work. But in 1995, the internet and even DNA profiling were new and only sparsely used. So if there's a chance Jennifer was actually murdered, we'd have to find a real person who was the assailant. And perhaps that newspaper bag offers a clue. It had room number 2816 written on it, a location just down the hallway by the elevators. The bag reveals an unknown fingerprint, but we could probably assume it belongs to the person who delivered the paper to 2816. My guess is that when Jennifer checked in and took the elevator upstairs, she saw the bag sitting in front of the door for room 2816 and realized the person had probably checked out that morning and nobody was going to pick up the paper given it was 11 p.m. We know she stayed in her room for the better part of her visit and only opened the door on a few occasions, so she might have been thinking that she'd read the paper at some point, but never did. Of course, the paper was USA Today, which is printed in English, and we know she was fluent, so she would have had a reason to read it. Now, this is when we learn there was actually a Belgian man staying on Jennifer's floor the night prior to her death. The man, supposedly a business traveler, only stayed one night and then checked out on Saturday, hours before Jennifer was shot. When he was asked to be interviewed by a journalist, he requested to know what it was about and then promptly refused to talk once he learned the reporter's intentions. He just didn't want to talk about this incident. Why? But pressing him finally gets him to open up a little bit. He says he never saw the woman, but knew about the incident because they told him at the front desk of the hotel when he checked out. He says they told him it was a suicide. Yet, when he checked out, the shooting was still hours away from happening. He's also from a French-speaking region of Belgium, bringing strong insinuations of a man known as Lois. When the journalist confronts him with the inconsistency about the check-in, he continues to assert they asked him at the front desk if he saw or heard anything suspicious the night before. He says that's all he knows. Yet, that would be impossible. So, is he hiding something? There's really nothing to connect this guy to the crime. He was contacted many years after the fact and was a known business traveler, so I'm thinking that he probably just misremembered. If there was anything there, I'm sure the police would have followed up on it. So, okay, the key cards for room 2805, where Jennifer stayed, were used only 5 times during her stay from Wednesday night through Saturday evening. Both were left in the room when she died. There was no evidence anybody had tampered with the access system in the lock. Jennifer did, however, appear to leave for a period of about 20 hours, and we can't account for her whereabouts. We can say, though, that the maid who entered her room during that time noticed nobody had slept on the bed the night before. So it does seem Jennifer was out, leading many to believe she was with another person. Yet we simply cannot validate that assertion by way of physical evidence. It's entirely possible she met someone, had a last fling, maybe just a one-night stand, and then returned the next morning to batten down the hatches and get ready to die. That's what it seems like to me, whether it was a one-night stand or she was alone. She went out onto the town one last time. Maybe she partied. Maybe she just contemplated. Maybe she walked and stared into nothingness forever. It's difficult to say, but I think some sort of spy activity for a foreign entity is really a stretch at this point. Now, we could also say that when Jennifer left the room and didn't return for at least 20 hours, that she had actually walked out of the room without bringing a key card, and then whomever was still inside the room just opened the door for her when she returned. In that case, a key card wouldn't be used and therefore wouldn't register in the system. But the room is never in a condition in which it seems occupied by a second person, especially since the bed was still made at the end of this 20-hour period. Beyond that, a message from the front desk sent on Thursday to the TV in room 2805 isn't acknowledged until 19 hours later. That happened during the window of at least 20 hours in which we think Jennifer was gone. So she stayed elsewhere. But where? I'd say she was either walking around nearly despondent, trying to work through the inevitable ending approaching so quickly, or had a one-night stand, or something similar. If she made contact with anyone she knew, she'd probably be identified after the fact by way of investigation. I'd say she was either alone or met someone she didn't know, someone to whom she might have lied and never saw again, and wouldn't be suspicious of her winding up dead from suicide a few days later. It's difficult to say. Now, there's also blood spatter evidence all over the scene in room 2805. I mean, it's a mess. It's everywhere. But there's no sign of it on Jennifer's hands, or even any indication she might have fired a gun. Still, she has no additional injuries, and there's no sign of a struggle. Nobody heard an argument. She was shot point blank in the forehead, so it's not like she couldn't have yelled for help when the security guard knocked on the door. She would have known the killer was there. She would have known her life was in danger. Yet, there should be both residue and blood spatter on the gun if this is a suicide. But we don't find that. However, one expert tells us that isn't proof of murder. It's merely proof of some type of unknown flaw in the investigative technique. In essence, what he's suggesting is that the samples appeared that way due to the manner in which they were tested and might have offered different results if retested. Unfortunately, much of the evidence in this case was destroyed long ago. Should this inconsistency make us pause? Yes. But the totality of evidence, in my opinion, is clear. This was a suicide. In 2016, the body of Jennifer Fergate was exhumed from its resting place and the bones were subjected to DNA testing in an effort to identify the young woman. Researchers were able to extract a complete DNA profile and determine the person is European, but in order to put a name to the face, they need a relative's DNA to appear in genealogical DNA databases, something that hasn't happened yet. But there's hope. Something like that could happen at any time. Or never. And it makes me ponder the answer to a question. Should we grant her wish of allowing her to fade into obscurity? Or do we take the chance that she might have some type of family remaining, a person or people who still wonder where she went? Is there someone out there whose heart is still broken due to her sudden departure and who lies awake at night with a glimmer of hope she'll return? Or at least consider she may never arrive, but wants to know the truth for closure? If there is someone like that, someone who cares, someone who's suffered, I believe we owe it to that individual and to ourselves collectively as humanity to keep searching, to never give up in the pursuit of shining a light on this darkness. Maybe she was loved. Maybe she's missed. Maybe she was looking for someone to stop her. Maybe that's what she did for 20 hours outside the hotel. Maybe she looked for a reason to keep going. Like we all do. We look for that thing. in the moment, and also in the scope of our entire lives. Maybe she couldn't find a reason to stay. Maybe that's how it manifested in her looking for it physically. Maybe a smile could have saved her. Maybe a moment of clarity. Maybe peace was better. I don't know. It's not for me to say. But I do believe if we can learn who Jennifer Fergate really was, by extension of that, we'll find people who give us the answer to why. We can solve the mystery. And if nothing else, that's who we are. That's what we do. We are all detectives. And it means that this case, like all others, is just a microcosm of our search for universal truth. And so, in searching for the identity of this unknown young woman, let us persist as though there's more at stake than one person's name. It's about our identity, where we come from, where we're going, what will be waiting when we arrive. But most of all, that we're here together on a magical journey in between, and no matter how much it may feel as though you're alone, we all walk that same path. Sometimes the truth is difficult to see when traveling by yourself in the darkness of night. Sometimes you have to call out for help, for the sound of a familiar voice. And when you hear it, just start running toward the comfort, the warmth, light. Sometimes it's too bright. Often it reveals too much. Things we don't want to see. And the closer you get, the uglier the picture becomes. You see that you lied to yourself. And it hurts. There's nowhere to hide from shame. So you realize the only way to cope is change. That's how you get to higher ground and save yourself from drowning. But for one reason or another, Jennifer Fergate lost the will to live. She ran into a black hole and disappeared, swallowed by time, by nothingness, by the cold hand of her unrelenting pride. In the aftermath, we're left to stare, silent, pondering mortality, waiting, wondering, hoping that when we see the floodwaters rising in our own lives, with nowhere left to run, we'll finally realize the only way to find freedom is learning to fly.